Welcome to Theatre Voice. My name's Heather Neal, and with me is Jonathan Crowell, author of over 20 books, including biographies of John Gielgud and Sybil Thorndike, to talk about his latest, Performing King Lear, Gielgud to Russell Beale, published by Bloomsbury under the Arden Shakespeare imprint. Well, thank you for coming, Jonathan. We're at the Young Vic, which is rather nice, where a Lear is going to go on tonight in Belarusian. But anyway, why did you want to do a book on King Lear?
Well, the origin was I did a book on Hamlet, on Simon Russell Beale's Hamlet at the National Theatre, where I sat in on rehearsals, and I thought it might be rather neat 10 years later to do a book on his Lear, but in fact it got delayed so long I got tied up with other things.
Oh, I see.
So, and then I realised he was already about to rehearse, and I thought that's too late. But then I thought, well, why don't I do King Lear anyway and talk to a range of people? And so I ended up talking to 20 actors who played it and
yes.
A couple of dozen directors.
Yes. Oh, did you talk to all the actors? Because some of them, one or two are dead, aren't they?
I didn't talk to the dead ones, no.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yes, no, when I say 20, they were the live ones.
Right.
And then there were others like Gielgud and Wolfert and Olivier, who I researched a bit, and although
right.
I didn't need to research Gielgud because I'd written his biography.
Yes. And you did have a bit of a coup in that you managed to speak to Sindon not very long before he died.
I did, yes. That was rather a moving occasion because I went down to his house in Kent, and as you probably know, he's a great theatre historian, was, and his house is filled with memorabilia. And so I talked to him in these surroundings, but he was very unwell, but still able to talk very articulately and movingly about playing King Lear. And he was thinking back, nearly 40 years, and
yes.
yet he had a good memory of how he'd done it and how he'd worked with the director and so on. So that was a very, that was my first interview, because I knew he didn't have long.
Right.
And that worked very well.
Yeah. Mm. Well, you've organised the book more or less chronologically, but also according to location, so
yes.
that you've got the major companies like the RSC and the National Theatre
yes.
and the Globe, we've done three.
Yes.
But also you've got a chapter on smaller venues
yes.
and one on ones for young people.
Yep.
And you go abroad just a little bit, but not too much. Why was that? You've got Michael Pennington in there.
Yes, I decided not to cover anything outside the UK, except in one or two instances where there was an English actor performing abroad or an English director directing abroad. So, as you say, Michael Pennington did it in Brooklyn.
Yes, last year that was, wasn't it?
That was last year,
yeah.
Yes. Jonathan Miller directed Christopher Plummer at Stratford, Ontario, and then subsequently in New York. And I also had Frank Langella, who played it at Chichester
yes.
here. And was directed by Angus Jackson, so I included him. And the other one was, who was the fourth one? Angela? Oh, Peter Ustinov, yes. Who, of course, was dead, but there was a book written about his production, so I based it on that. And he was being directed by Robin Phillips, who was English, so
yes.
those were the four exceptions.
Well, Miller is someone who directed it a number of times.
Mm.
Did you get any sense of change or development, or was he always responding mainly to the actor?
He certainly was responding to the different actors who played the part. He had.
Perhaps we should say who they were.
Yes, he started with Michael Horden at the Nottingham Playhouse, and then did it twice on television with Horden. He then worked with Eric Porter at the Old Vic, and the final one was with Christopher Plummer in Canada. And I suppose he had very strong views about, as you'd expect, about when to set the play, and he wanted it to be contemporary with Shakespeare. He didn't want to go to the pagan end, nor did he want to do it in modern dress, and therefore with some variety his productions were set 17th century Jacobite period, but he did confess that as he went on he got a little less likely to give learned talks to the cast and to respond more to their ideas and play it more by ear. So that was certainly one development. And The people who I didn't actually talk to anyone, but there was written documents which gave people like Gemma Jones talking about Miller as a director, Penelope Wilton also, and they all said that he was very good at taking their ideas, very flexible, very relaxed in rehearsal, very informal, and very jokey, among other things as well, and made them laugh. And Horden worked with him very well. He also wrote about the experience and said that it was wonderful to work with such an intelligent man, who of course was a doctor as well,
yes,
and therefore could give the kind of medical background.
Yeah, so then we come to the question about dementia and madness and different actors' approach, and different directors, of course.
Yes.
They have to work together as far as possible.
Yes.
Because some of them think he was mad, some of them think he was a joker, some of them
yes.
think he actually was going into dementia and knew that at the beginning.
Yes.
So did you have a set of questions where you sort of tried to get two different versions of that sort of attack?
I sort of did to begin with, but we, after a while, I realised that people were going to cover certain things anyway. I hardly needed to ask them. That, of course, was one of the key things that came up. And what surprised me, well, perhaps it didn't surprise me, what amazed me was the variety of interpretations and ideas of different directors and different actors. As you say, normally working together, so that, you know, sometimes there was a very strong, powerful king. I don't know if you saw Simon Russell Beale last
yes.
year, but he played him as a kind of Stalinist figure.
Almost fascist, yes.
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 And
much use of the soldiery, which
yes.
that which came about in rehearsals, I believe, didn't it?
I don't know that it might well have done. Do you mean the numbers or the...
Yes, the numbers and what they actually did, because
yes.
didn't you say in the book that the cast were being the supernumeraries
yes.
in rehearsal
yes.
until they got the people
absolutely.
Who weren't being properly
yes.
paid, or paid as much, I should say, not properly. so they got a lot of ideas together before
yes.
They
did
the people
indeed.
Who came in
yes. Yes.
and weren't part of the main cast.
Yes, and... in fact, they rejected an awful lot of different ideas, not just with the supernumeraries, as they call them, but also with the ideas. For example, Simon was telling me how they tested different ideas for the scene in which he, the birds in the cage speech at the end with Cordelia, and they experimented with different ideas there. And in the end, they were all too complicated, so they just sat there together. but obviously, Sam Mendes was very keen to try lots of different ideas and to take ideas from the cast
yeah.
as well. As he yeah. put it, there are all kinds of intelligent people in the room who know as much as I do, so I act as editor.
Yes, and sometimes decisions are made simply for pragmatic reasons, aren't they? I mean... Derek Jacobi doing Blow Winds in a very whispery voice.
Yes, yes, that was interesting.
Because he didn't think he would be able to carry it.
Well, yes, Michael Grandich, who was directing,
yeah.
thought that with all the sort of anger and power and rage in the first part of
yeah.
the play, that Derek wouldn't be able to sustain it in the storm. So he said, why didn't you whisper it? And,
yeah.
and then it became an idea that they wanted to
yes.
Realise fully. And I didn't actually see it, but I gather it worked rather well, although it was controversial.
Yes. Well, that's a case where you have an idea which seems the right thing for a production, and you get another actor saying, well, I didn't want to do that. And Michael Pennington actually, I think, said that, didn't he?
Yes.
How was I going to cope with all the storm going on, and my voice had to last out, but I really didn't want to whisper it. And then they came about, they sort of worked out a kind of choreography for the sound, didn't they?
Yes, that's right.
So he knew when it was going to be very loud.
Absolutely.
And then they'd let him speak between
yes,
times.
Yes, that's right. In fact, he wasn't, I mean, sure there were several who did that, but I noticed, I remember Donald Sinden telling me that that's how he... got through the storm, because it is so often a great contest between the sound people
yes.
and the actor
yeah.
who's bellowing and trying to make himself heard.
Yeah.
Even Wolfit had problems, and that's saying something.
Well, yes, and Don Sinden's voice was pretty loud.
Exactly, yes, yes. So, but
yes, Sinden was much influenced by Wolfit, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
He was a great admirer of him. I mean, I quote him in the book as totally over the top about how wonderful he was, which was not a view that everybody shared,
yeah.
but he certainly had power, and Agate called his Lear a fantastic performance, so You never know.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if you actually start off with giving some historical context, don't you? We don't go straight into modern times. It's interesting to me that there seems to be more and more psychology the further you go on, because now we have all the Lear family talking about their backstory and how one of them was abused and then one of them was a favourite and so on.
Yes.
And they all seem to need to have a very, very clear view of what has happened in the household before.
Yes.
You think that's a fairly modern thing? Well, fairly, in the last 50 years, I suppose.
Yes. Well, I think it is. It's as you say, it's become much more noticeable, although not everybody wants to do it. Mm. A lot of actors do find it valuable exploring this the backstory, and in particular Lear's relationship with his daughters, but also the mothers. Who were the mothers?
Yes.
Well, was it one or two?
Yes, and quite often you get someone who decides that the mother died giving birth to gonorrhoea.
Mm.
What? So then there must have been a second wife. Or the mother died giving birth to Cordelia.
Yes, absolutely. There are all kinds of... There's a variation. There are variations.
I remember the first production at the Globe, and it was never made clear, but I interviewed somebody and found out that the director had thought that there were three different mothers, and each one of the daughters had a different hair colour.
Oh, right, that's right, yes. And he cast them looking. Cast deliberately
looking
the actors for that reason.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. And of course you get in, I think it's the Jonathan Pryce one, there's a black actor playing, or an actress rather, playing Regan, I think, or Gomer, one of the two.
Yes. Now, well, we're used to colourblind casting, of course, and I don't suppose anyone turned a hair about one of the daughters, but it's very much more unusual for King Lear to be black, but there have been two, Nonso and Nonsier, who...
Yes.
Was, I think, even more unusual in that he was about 22 or something.
He was, yes. Yeah. He was, because the production done by Declan Donnellan was, they recruited people straight out of drama school. This was a kind of slightly educational thing at Stratford.
That's right. They had sort of an apprentice thing,
didn't
they?
Yeah, an academy, I think it was called.
That's right.
And so the whole cast were, he was the only black actor, as it happens, but he was cast as Lear. And similarly with Joseph Marcel at the Globe last year. I talked to him immediately after I watched him play the role, and he was very interesting. And he said it was a great compliment and most unusual for a non-white actor to play the part. But of course, what people didn't know, perhaps because he was well known on television, that he'd had a lot of Shakespearean experience anyway with the RSC and other companies.
And he has a very RP way of speaking, doesn't
he? Does,
he?
Yes. Yeah. And he's got great energy. And I forget his age now. But
I think he's in his mid-60s, isn't he?
Is he?
He's about sort of the age you ought to be, probably, to play Lear. Because
that's
always another problem, isn't it? You're supposed to be 80, and yet you're supposed to have all that energy still.
Yes.
Some sort of manic energy, but also to be able to carry Cordelia, as they always say.
Yes. But what surprised me was that the huge range of ages that... I mean, William Devlin was 22 when he did it. I mean, that's back, we're talking about back in the 30s now. And Gielgud played it at 25 or 26. But the people I talked to, some of them had played it in their... Tim West had played it in his 30s, his late 30s. Paul Shelley and Schofield, in fact, not that I talked to him, were around about the 40 mark.
Yes.
And then you had people like Frank Langella, who was, I think, 76, something like that. Probably the oldest one.
Yes, it seems to me people are more aware of age now, of actors' ages.
Mm.
And it may be partly because... everyone expects at some point to see a video or a close-up or a close-up photograph.
And yes.
I don't suppose you would have... Well, they had photography, of course, but when William Devlin did it, wouldn't have been widely disseminated, I imagine.
No, I don't think so. I couldn't find a photograph of him for a start. But he had the sort of... he had a powerful face, and I think this...
Well, it's the presence that matters, isn't it? I mean, Nonso has an extraordinary presence.
Yes, so he's done very well subsequently. Yes. Mm. I think he's played Othello. And what you need is presence, which makes you wonder if how somebody like Ian Holm, who is quite short...
diminutive,
but he had great power. star in that production.
He did,
and
yes.
He was astonishingly good, I think. So you can get away with it if you've got the ability, the talent, I think, to project power and charisma.
Yes. Well, I mean, Napoleon wasn't very big. I suppose that sometimes people have great force who are not very big physically, I suppose.
Yes.
But certainly in Holden, he was terrifying as the father,
at the beginning. Yes, he was. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Derek Jacobi, just looking at the cover of the book, I mean, he's rather good-natured, genial character and very unconfrontational, as he puts it, in the book. And yet he exuded great power, but he was within the Donmar. And I think the play works extremely well in a smaller space.
Yes, you're right. I mean, and it does make an enormous difference. I mean, the Ian Holm one was in at the National Theatre, but at the Consulate.
Yes, absolutely. Because the set was very bare, very stark, the costumes were simple, they were all just dark, they didn't hardly differentiate.
This is the Jacobi one. Yes, it was all white, wasn't it?
The boards, the floor and the walls were all white. Yes, a very stark set, very abstract. And you concentrated on the text and the relationship between them. And of course, Michael Grandage, who directed it, treated it as a family affair. And so you didn't get the cosmic element, as almost impossible in a small space like that. Same with the Southwark Playhouse when Oliver Cotton did it. You know, they had little domestic scenes, but Jack Shepherd, who directed it, told me that he just felt they couldn't get the end. When the state disintegrates, it was almost impossible to do in such a tiny space.
Was that one where he wanted the set to fall down? Was that? I mean,
no.
It actually did fall down in Holm one.
It did,
at the National.
No, you're thinking, I think, of the Almeida.
Oh, yes. Was that the
Michael Attenborough
one? Michael Attenborough.
Yes, yes. And the budget didn't run to the set falling down. Yes.
Who was that? That was,
Oliver Ford Davis.
Oliver Ford Davis, that's right.
Yes.
And when you say the Almeida, that's why I was not joining up in my brain, because it was when the
Almeida... I'm sorry, I'm getting mixed up here. Oliver Ford Davis did it at the Almeida.
He did it at the Almeida.
Jonathan Kent.
That's right, but it wasn't at the Almeida. It was the Almeida was away from home. It was,
that's right, King's Cross.
That's right,
station.
It's all confusing. Yes.
Yes. And
Oliver Ford Davis. Well, he's another one who you think of as rather good-natured and not loud voice. And I think he did have some trouble with his voice, didn't he?
Well, he told me that he did have some differences with Jonathan Kent, who knew the kind of person he was and wanted him to be more angry. He was saying he was being too measured in rehearsal, too restrained. And Oliver was doing his best to do that. But he said after a bit, you know, anger gets the variety. You can't get variety in anger very easily. So I think there was some disagreements there.
Yes.
In fact, I came across several partnerships where there was conflict between the director and the actor. One notable one was when Rupert Gould directed Pete Postlethwaite.
That's a famous one, isn't
it? Yes, and full of gimmicks.
I saw it when it came to the Young Vic.
Oh, yes.
Apparently they'd shaved away quite a few
of the
strangeness.
Yes, but Pete Postlethwaite really complained. Again, he was not alive, of course, but he wrote a memoir and he talked about how angry he was at all these gimmicks, and they had great rows in rehearsal. Turns out some of the gimmicks were his ideas, so Rupert Gould told me.
Yes, wearing a dress at Dover, that was his idea.
Absolutely, yes. And I think the Mrs. Thatcher speech
at
the
beginning yes.
was.
But they dropped that by the Young Vic,
haven't
they?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Rupert regretted that, apparently.
Yes, and he said he thought it was one of his best Shakespeare productions, too.
He did, yes. And
it's interesting, that, isn't it? How different a director's view can be of the overall effect.
Yes.
The critics, who I suppose have to stand for some extent for the audience, as
it were. Yes. Well, what I found interesting was one question I always asked, usually at the end of the interview, was what. This is to the actors, well, and the directors, what they thought of either their performance or the production. And all of them in different ways said that Lear's a part you can never get the whole of. You know, you've got all the different aspects, and some nights you can get some of the scenes right and other nights you get different scenes, but you can never pull it all together. And Michael Pennington described it as sometimes you score an ace, you serve an ace, and next time it's in the net. Yes. And that was a very common thought.
Yes. Corin Redgrave one was criticised for not joining it all together and being too fragmented, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. He was interesting because I managed to get hold of some letters that he wrote just before.
I was going to say he would have died before you. Well,
yes,
quite a while
yes, he did,
you.
Yes. But he wrote in the few days before he started doing Lear, and then in early in the rehearsals, he was writing to the director, Annie Castledine, who was a friend, really revealing his inner thoughts about how daunting the part was and how he didn't think he was really cut out to play it. You know, very honest letters and fascinating. And so that gave a lot of life to his account of it. And then I interviewed Bill Alexander, who directed, and got a similar view. But that was a very political version, which, as you say, was not altogether satisfactory. But I think there is more and more concentration on the political side of the play, the naked wretches, the social injustice.
There have been a couple of productions where they were actually on stage.
Yes, I have.
I think Dominic Drongul did that at the Globe.
Yes, and so did I think it was Jude Kelly at the Western
Playhouse.
Right,
yeah.
Yes, he recruited people from the town.
Yes, I just think we ought to say who was Lear when Michael Attenborough directed. But that wasn't the...
Oh, that was Jonathan Pryce.
It was Jonathan Pryce.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't realise you were...
Holding back, because I saw that and I loved it.
Yes.
He's such a... and he was a very strong Lear, but quite jokey as well.
Yes. I suppose the jokiest version, in a way, certainly at the beginning, was Brian Cox's at the National.
At the National.
With Deborah Warner directed, where he came
in a wheelchair with a red nose and
sort of, it was going to be a party, and he was going to have this funny game where he tested his daughters about their love. You know, and it was his second childhood, as it were.
Yes.
And that worked very well, I believe.
Yes.
I didn't see it.
I saw it, and the night I saw it, this is a little anecdote, it's got nothing to do with the production, really, but he had to throw Cordelia's coronet in anger off the stage, and he missed through, and it hits a woman in the front row.
Oh, goodness.
And that's quite an interesting point, where everyone's anxious about something real, not the tragedy on stage, because she was hurt and she had to be taken away.
Oh my goodness.
And he had to keep in character, of course, but he came on at the end looking very worried. But he's also one example of someone who admitted to finding it exhausting, didn't he?
Yes.
And he virtually had a breakdown, really.
Yes. No, his personal life was in tatters at that time, so that didn't help. But he did find it really exhausting. And at one point, he even asked David Bradley, who was understudying, if he'd go on the next night, because he came into the wings and said, "I just can't do this anymore." But it's a hugely exhausting part. And I mean, Brian.
So I'm aware that we're dotting about in time quite a lot.
Yes.
When was that one? Was that the.
Who? Brian Cox?
Brian Cox.
1990.
One. 1990, that's right.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
But it's such a huge part, and Greg Hicks had a rather good description of it. He said that if
he did it for the RSC.
Oh yeah, sorry, he did it for the RSC in 2000 and something, and he said the more you plummet, the more you realise that you'll never get to the bottom, and there's always 1,000 feet to go.
Yes, I remember he came on. He sort of erupted on stage. I saw that at the Roundhouse.
Mm.
You know, aha, surprise sort of thing. You know.
At the beginning?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
But that, wasn't Catherine Hunter the fool in that?
She was, yes. But of course, she most famously played
Lear herself.
Yes, which...
in a mental hospital or a care home.
Yes.
Wasn't it?
What was interesting talking to her was how she explained that she was trying to get inside the mentality of a man. She was trying to get away from thinking of things from a woman's point of view. But on the other hand, she didn't want to totally transform, so it was a kind of mixture.
She'd always wanted to play Lear since the age of 14 or something.
I know, that was sort of remarkable. Yeah. She said she had a very close affinity with old people from that early age, when she used to go and help in old people's homes and things. And
so that was that. In, that was in the '80s, wasn't it? That one.
What was that? The 90s.
It's so difficult to keep them. Well, we don't. Yeah. I'm sure people can.
What was interesting about hers was that she was very small, of course. She's 5 foot.
But got a good voice.
A good, very low voice as well, which helped. And she was dressed in she had a long white hair and a goatee beard, and she was in clothes that were much too big for her, you know.
Yeah.
And she looked rather remarkable.
Yes.
And
1997 that was, by the way. And it was Leicester, wasn't it?
Yes, and then it came to the Young Vic.
Yes.
So she said that she was intimidated enough coming on as Lear, but the fact that she was having to prove that a woman could play the part made it an extra strain. But she seems to have convinced a lot of people that it worked, it could work. I did see, as I say very briefly in the book, I did see Ursula Moron play Queen Lear, as it were. She played her as a woman, but it didn't work very well, I don't think, and I didn't interview her.
No, I noticed that you left her out.
Yes.
And you left David Ryle out as well, didn't you?
Well, because I think you saw it, didn't you?
I did, yes.
He was ill and he had to hold a script while he was playing it.
And anyone who'd seen him in earlier days would have not wanted him to be remembered for that.
Exactly. Really. So I thought I won't even try to interview him or describe it, because it would be unfair. Yeah.
Okay, well, we talked a bit about smaller spaces. Joe Marcel, you mentioned, who appeared at the Globe, but he was also on tour and had to adjust for different spaces.
Yes.
Did he talk about that?
Yes, he did. They went to a huge range of places. I mean, they did it for 2 seasons. He came to the conclusion that he liked playing outside, which was quite surprising, with all the kind of interruptions you can get from cars or pigeons or whatever it might be, music around the place. But he really liked doing that, and he liked the kind of audience responses that they got sometimes. Like, for example, when Edmund has to choose between Regan and Cordelia, so when he says, "Which one shall I have?" and somebody yells out, "Both!" from the audience.
Yes, that annoyed a lot of critics. That was
Yes. That happens at the Globe, of course, more often than other places.
Well, it only happens once.
Yes.
But
I don't mean just that.
No.
All sorts of
audience interaction. Yes. Because you can see them all. They know you can see them.
But it's changed. I mean, people were saying that the Globe has evolved, and it's not so much.
Well,
like
I think
that.
People started off by acting being what they thought an Elizabethan audience was, which is
absolutely.
Probably quite wrong anyway.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
But they just go and listen now. Generally.
Yes. Yes.
Which is rather better. Well, of course, they respond as well. But
it was interesting comparing the three Lears that had, three actors that had played Lear at the Globe in this century, Julian Glover, David Calder, and then Joseph Marcel, how they responded to playing in the open air, which differed. I mean, Julian was very, found it very tough competing with the helicopters that came down the Thames and so on.
And I think they were worse in those days.
Yes, I think they were.
Because some arrangements have been made, people are a bit kinder generally now.
Yes.
There used to be tourists who just come and watch, you know, above the stage.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that. Yes. Well, he called it, we're doing King Lear in Vietnam.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the relationship with the Fool, because in the David Calder production, the Fool was very young, that's not the first time that's been done, and of course people do argue that the Fool was probably played by the same actor who played Cordelia, which is a possibility.
Yes. It was done like that in Joseph Marcel's one.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Yes.
I didn't actually manage to see that, although I spoke to him about it. It was also done in the one that Deborah Warner did, wasn't it?
No, they thought about it, but
she wanted to have Fiona Shaw.
She
didn't
did,
she?
Yes, but
and
Brian Cox
she didn't.
Didn't like that idea.
So, who was that? An older or a young one?
Oh, now who played the fool for Brian Cox? I can't remember this
movie.
oh, yes, David Bradley.
Oh, of course it was David Bradley. Yes. Well, he was about the same age as Brian Cox, wasn't he?
There were different. I mean, when Ian Holm did it, he had Michael Bryant as the fool.
That's right, he was a bit older, I think.
A bit older, absolutely. Yeah. Whereas, for example, Michael Pennington had a 19-year-old American actor. So it was much more of a father-son relationship.
I think it's Aaron Alvis I was thinking of saying that, you know, going back to the Cordelia thing.
Oh, right, yes.
Who, yes. She directed Michael Pennington, of course.
Yes,
last year. So we've got... now, you can make an argument either one way or the other, but the fool is such a changeable character,
yes.
isn't it? And it's, I'm sure, you know, every time you see Lear, the fool is... Different,
yes.
Not just age, but all sorts of things.
No, I mean, sometimes they're music hall comedians.
Yeah.
Michael Williams played it in that sort of way. Interestingly, he played it twice. He played it, first of all, with Eric Porter.
That was Jonathan Miller's.
No,
that wasn't. That was because Eric Porter did it. So,
it's confusing.
I hope this isn't confusing people to listen to. Because Eric Porter did it several times as well.
Eric
right.
Porter, Michael Williams played the fool. Mm. And he played him as young. Then he, 8 years later, Donald Sinden, he played him as an old, bald-pated northern comedian. And Anthony Scher played him as, when he, with Gambon in 1983, he played him as a music hall clown.
Yes,
and they did a kind of double act, and there was a sort of ventriloquist dummy moment as well.
And... yes, Corin Redgrave had two fools, I seem to remember, a different one at Stratford from the one
did he? I've forgotten
came
that.
To,
yes.
to London.
Yes.
And but in that one, the fool goes off clearly to his death.
Yes.
And that's another thing which is handled very differently.
Yes.
There's been some productions where the fool is hanged on stage.
Yes.
Yes, that was in the Ian McKellen's one directed by...
Trevor Nunn.
The fool died on stage in that.
But more sensationally, he's been killed on the stage in Simon Russell Beale's Sam Mendes production.
Yes.
This happened, and I thought that was at the time. I thought maybe that was the first time, but in fact, it happened before. It happened when Gambon played Lear.
Right.
It happened when Robert Stevens played Lear. So it wasn't new then.
No.
It's interesting how these things go on. Through the time, and often things are done which are thought to be new, but even by the director, perhaps, and then you look back and it's already happened before.
Yes. Well, the fool is called Boy.
Yes.
Calls him Boy, but
yes.
And if indeed he did double with Cordelia, he would have had to be a boy.
But then the argument, and I think Jonathan Miller is one of those who makes it, is that it was just a term of affection.
Yes.
They've been together all their lives, as it were.
Yeah. Yes, because he's very daring in what he says to him, and and he knows him very well.
Yes, absolutely.
Very, very well.
Yes, and they're all kind of interesting theories. Again, the backstory is how they met, and you know, where he was playing in a some sort of show, and Lear went along to the show and saw him and said, "Come and work with me." You know, all kind of fanciful ideas that people have had over the years.
No doubt, it does help the actors, I suppose, to be certain. Of that sort of thing, even though it doesn't perhaps cross the footlights.
No, it doesn't, because it can't unless you're adding lines, as it were.
And it probably shouldn't.
No.
Although such things as how informal people are with each other and so on, that comes out of that sort of talk, doesn't it?
It's interesting when Derek Jacobi was talking about the obscurities in the language, and that particularly applies to the fool, I suppose. But he said, as far as when Lear is talking, he doesn't worry too much about that, because usually the context will tell you. And also, if you're using your body language in a way that is appropriate, the audience understands what you're thinking and feeling. I thought that was an interesting observation.
Yes. Well, Ian Holm opted for nudity. And what year was that? Was that 1997? Oh, I thought it was 1995. Okay. And of course, it's true that does draw attention and some other actors say that's not the thing to do because it's the wrong sort of attention. But there have been others who've gone completely.
Oh, McKellen,
lead, haven't they?
McKellen has.
Oh, I quite didn't even remember that. Right. Yes.
But I think that.
And often Edgar is, of course. But that does make sense.
Yes, Paul, yes. I think another argument against it is that it draws attention to the actor and
yes,
not the character.
Not character
and
yes.
That does seem a shame to me.
Yes. Yes. Mm. Well, it's one of the things that get discussed in rehearsals. I
yes.
like the fact that Richard Eyre came up with a list of tips before they started.
Yes, yes, that yes, that was good.
Yeah.
And on the nudity question,
that was Ian Holmplett.
Tim Pigott-Smith said there were just two conditions before he agreed to do it. One was not having any rain in the storm, and then the other was no nudity.
Oh, yes, rain, that's another thing, because that's another, can be another distraction, can't it?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, that was that less, that was Leicester, wasn't it? Was it Leeds?
What?
No,
it was,
Tim Pigott-Smith.
Yes, it was Leeds. No, West Yorkshire.
West, right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right, it was Ian Brown, of course. West Yorkshire Playhouse.
Mm.
Yes.
Ian Brown.
Yes, he was very good. But they had a very odd set. Well, that's something we haven't talked about at all.
Yes.
I mean, we had the collapsing set in the in-home one.
Yes.
And the would-be
yes.
collapsing set in other ones.
Yes.
And,
yes.
and others, like at the Globe or, the, or touring ones with virtually no set.
Mm.
So what sort of difference does it make? I mean, the Corin Redgrave one, which
yes.
was an RSC production.
Yes.
That had a kind of mixture of styles, didn't it? That
I didn't see it, actually,
that was
so
sort of
I'm not really up on that
one. A bit medieval and a bit Edwardian.
That often happened. In fact, it happened with the costumes as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
They'd start off often in not exactly pagan clothes, but old, pre-modern clothes. And then gradually they would introduce, or the director would introduce...
That's right.
Modern touches and
yes, and then but then you usually have a duel at the end because you can't. It's very difficult.
That makes it a problem, doesn't
yes.
it?
Actually, we've been talking for quite a long time,
right.
and I didn't realise how much time had gone by, Jonathan.
Okay,
but thank you very much for talking about King Lear, and I'm sure anyone who reads the book or sees a lot of King Lear's could talk all night about King Lear.
Well, it's a fascinating play, and it's there's so many aspects to it that you could indeed talk all night.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.